Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
This week, I am inside the Madison County History Museum to talk about a festival that took place many years ago here, an unbelievable festival. The three people I'm with have some affiliation with it. Greg Drexelius, Lyle Ward, Jack Tweston. Gentlemen, thanks so much for inviting me here. All around us are pictures from the Mississippi River Festival, which took place from 1969 to 1980. And these are pictures of a who's who of people in all arts, music and theater and dance and symphony. And everyone that's listening right now would recognize almost all of these pictures. It is amazing. So we'll get to those names. But let's start with a little history. I'll let you start, Lyle. Background. 1969 was the first festival. How did this all come about and why?
The president of the St. Louis Symphony Orchestra went to meet with the president of Southern Illinois University. This campus had been open only 2 years. The St. Louis Symphony wanted a summer home. They had two reasons. One was really critical, and that is that the unions had just signed their first labor contract. They also had just bought what's now Powell Theater, and it was quite a burden for them to buy it and then renovate it. So the university, the president and vice president, were very interested immediately. They were interested because it was such a brand new university.
And we're, of course, talking about SIU Edwardsville.
Yes, SIU Edwardsville. They had realized quickly that we had a problem drawing people from St. Louis.
Well, looking around the room here with the photos, Janis Joplin and Bob Dylan and John Denver and Linda Ronstadt and Chuck Berry and Bob Hope, James Taylor. How did you get all these people to come to this festival?
Well, at first it was difficult getting them to understand what the festival was and who we were and where we were. But as a few years went through, it became very easy because the word had got out and the artists wanted to be here.
So, Greg, what was your affiliation with the festival?
Okay, I was the tent usher for 4 years from 1970 to 73. And then I was in charge of the tent ushers in 74. And then I was in charge of the people doing ground security and ticket collection area in 75.
What has prompted you to revive the history of this festival for people to see, come to the museum here?
This festival was unique. You know, it fit in a time when people were just starting to really get into the music and such that was going on. It's like a trip in the Wayback Machine. I always say that when you go out to the site, that if you listen really hard, you can still hear it.
Where is the site?
the site is out on SIU, and it's there. It's overgrown now or whatever, but you can still get an idea of what it was all about.
What was the attendance like?
Oh, for example, when the WHO was here, that was 30,000 people.
Yeah.
You know, that showed up. That was the biggest we had.
We only shot for 100,000 for a season.
And just tell me again some of the names that came through here that kind of were big draws during that time.
I think number two was the Eagles, right? The Eagles, which came several times, but I think the when Hotel California came out, 76, 77, I think they were at 20,000 plus, right, Lyle? The thing to tag on to what Lyle said about, you know, the awareness it brought to the university and the variety of acts that came through, most of which, as you recognize, is kind of household names, but many of them were just up-and-comers at the time. You know, in 69, Joni Mitchell was a young singer-songwriter making her way out in Greenwich Village and those kind of places, but came here and played with Arla Guthrie.
That I was going down a mountain road on my motorcycle, doing 150 miles an hour, playing my guitar. Bob was playing the bass in the sidecar.
And both very young, fresh-faced singer-songwriters who went on to have, you know, lifelong careers, but at that time, not that all that well-known. So you could have had, I saw Gordon Lightfoot in about 75, and there was only about 2,000 of us there for that show.
Oh, wow. Now, Jack, you're doing a documentary about the festival, right?
Yes. Tell me about that.
Well, it grew out of my time as a student worker and just being a budding photographer and a family friend with Charlie Cox, a campus photographer. When the festival closed in 1980, I was doing a student project and decided give Charlie a call and see if I might be able to use some of his slides and photographs to kind of start a document of the closing of the festival, which was breaking all of our hearts, and we'll get into that later, how that came about. But so I did. I did a student project, and as a poor college student, duped some slides to kind of get me started on that. Years later, after raising a family and being a lifelong musician myself, I decided it might be a good idea to revive this student project I started in 1980, and so it's grown into it.
You started in 1980?
Well, sort of, yeah. You know, I've been shooting other people's things for all these 40 years, commercials and other documentaries and corporate videos and films and music videos and things like that. So I didn't really start that idea. It grew out of a student project idea to, in later years, becoming why not actually finish a documentary some many years later. So.
Do you have video footage from those days, or is it all stills? And
there was a film shot in 1969 that was released in 70, kind of documenting the first year that Lon mentioned. And then there was one by a friend of mine, Dick Taylor, that they did in 75. So there is some footage of Bob Hope, REO Speedwagon, Harry Chapin, and others from the 75 film. But outside of that, I mean, there was signs up that said, you know, no photography. So there's, outside of the people who were actually, you know, working there to get photos, there's not a lot of footage.
That's a challenge as a documentarian.
It is. But thanks to Lyle and Charlie Cox and some other photographer friends, there is some really good documentation of who was there.
So in 1969, there was a show on public broadcasting called The Sounds of Summer, narrated by Steve Allen. And they did an extensive shot of Joni Mitchell and Arlo Guthrie concert out there. And it is online out there. You can see a lot of it, almost the entire thing, but it is in the National Archives. The whole thing is, I believe, in the National Archives.
The National Archives.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, that's one. But there's not many things that give you the real aspects of what it was to be on stage or whatever there.
Well, this,
I'm trying to get access to that footage. I've been trying for a few years to get access to that footage. Steve Allen wasn't actually there. He was at a green screen out in California, probably, and said, "And here she is now, Joni Mitchell." You could tell the turn was kind of awkward.
So, Greg, tell me about the connection with the St. Louis Symphony.
The thing that became very obvious with the symphony when you were working out there is that there's nothing like that music with our sound system that we had on a starry night just enveloping you. It just was wonderful. You know, it just it filled every crevice there was. You know, and just, I can't say enough. You may get a little old lady that might poke you with an umbrella on those nights, but pretty sure that lady was not going to bounce a soda can off your head.
Yeah, that's funny. And Jack, tell me about some of the firsts that took place at the Mississippi River Festival.
Well, as you read about in the book, but one of the most important things, I think, is that the founders of the festival walked the campus and found several places in consideration for holding the festival. Settled on an area just, is it north of campus?
West.
Just west of campus that was kind of a natural bowl, and cleared some trees. And when they put the site there, as Lyle said, it was going to be a temporary shell and then maybe grow into something more permanent. But a lot of firsts technically were done there. The first year, Bob Shaw was the sound guy for the symphony. He was doing it early on in that first year of 69 until Iron Butterfly came in. It was a pretty heavy hitting band at the time and blew out his Bozak speakers, as you'll read in the book. So he called our friend Bob Heil and brought Bob in to do sound for the contemporary acts. Bob did things like one of the first delays systems, so the sound would reach the people at the back of the bowl at the same time, and you wouldn't get that staggered echo effect. I understand, I didn't know this until years later, but one of the first venues that actually pumped air conditioning in for the symphony, because on a hot July day, the strings on the violins wouldn't stay in tune very well with the swinging humidity and hot temperatures. So that was climate controlled somewhat for an outdoor venue, which is, I don't think had been done much at Lyle before.
I wasn't aware of it.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
So
it started in 1969. There's another music festival. I can't think of the name of it that started in 1969. I'm joking, of course. Woodstock started in 1969. It came out the same summer. So what was the kind of synergy between this festival and Woodstock?
For me, it was very little. Maybe that's because we're an isolated Midwest audience, but we were on the right path to build one that had a lot of credibility and had a wide range. It was not a rock and roll festival by design, and it was the biggest difference between us. We had the talent that was just as equal, and the response was equal. With the exception of having a million people at something. But the thing that was kind of reinforcing is the fact that six of our artists that we had this previous year ended up being brought there after they were with us. And that was kind of a unique thing and showing we were going the right direction.
I would say so. So the festival goes on and is a success, and you get all these people, more than a million people, to come here. And then what happened in 1980, the last one?
If I can go back to Woodstock for a minute, I think one of the other things that kind of set it apart as far as history will show is Woodstock was 3 days of peace, love, and mud from people I know that were there. But there was a soundtrack and there was a film that was shot. So the mystique about Woodstock grew over the years because there was that documentation. Like Lyle said, six artists that played early in 69 before they went to Woodstock played at the Mississippi River Festival. But there's not a whole lot of documentation to keep that going on. It went on 11, 12 years till 1980, so every year was returning symphonies and jazz acts and dance acts and contemporary acts. So the length of time and the artists that came through the River Festival far outshines what Woodstock had.
All good things must come to an end, I guess. So what happened?
There's a lot of different opinions of that, of course, of anything important. The university administration was changing, and was changing rapidly. They had been through a couple short-term presidents and acting presidents. they had a new one coming in, and the festival, like all big festivals, had some critics. There were people who owned property here, for example, and others that just didn't want it, and their opinions probably didn't change too much. They had owned a lot of property here. So the administration did not support what the early administrations did for all those years, and their solution was to go to a corporation that could come in and take all of the responsibility of doing it, taking advantage of the site that was there for them. They chose to go with a company from New York City, and they played for 2.5 years, I guess, seasons, and there were only a few concerts each time, and they were all rock and roll, basically. So it wasn't the mission that we had wanted, and so it was discontinued.
There is an exhibit here that people can come visit, right? So tell me about this exhibit, about the Mississippi River Festival. Photos all around us. There are artifacts like tickets and magazine covers and all kinds of things that so people are able to come see it right now.
Yes, that's true. I started the collection literally the first year of the festival. Working there, I had access to a number of the artists, and the staff really had. So over the course of all of those years, this just kept accumulating, and after that, people donated our loan things in it, which you would see here.
You gotta come see this. Guys, Greg, Lyle, Jack, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Whatever happens today, take it on with a fresh cup of True Brew Coffee. Now only $1 with True Rewards. True North Store's True Brew Coffee is a hot, flavorful gourmet blend created from coffee beans from around the world. As a free True Rewards member, pick the size that is perfect for you and pay only $1. Don't have the True Rewards mobile app? Find it in the Apple or Google Play Store to download and save instantly. True North Convenience Stores. Fast, friendly, clean.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Once upon an office so dreary, Wendy's HR presentation made everyone weary.
Was it a bore?
A snore. Could have used more charm, for sure.
That's it?
Wendy opened Canva, looking ecstatic. She began to work her magic.
Docs, prints, presentations galore. All in one design. Not dull anymore.
The next day, Wendy wowed the crowd. They clapped loud.
I feel so proud.
Now, imagine what your dreams can become when you put imagination to work at Canva.com.
Think advertising on TikTok isn't for your business? Think again.
We've generated over 100,000 leads, which has converted into over 40,000 sales for our pet insurance policies. My name is Trey Farrow. I am the CEO of Spot Pet Insurance. TikTok's Smart Plus AI-powered automation takes the guesswork out of targeting, bidding, and optimizing creative. If I can advertise on TikTok, you can too.
Drive more leads and scale your business today, only on TikTok. Head over to getstarted.tiktok.com/TikTok ads.